He kind of started all the plants growing, and he started people. Well, I guess he's kind of big and fat.
He can see us whatever we do. Whatever we do, he has such powerful eyes. He doesn't have millions and thousands and billions. And he can still see us when we're bad.
He could be sitting on the table right now, but you can't see him.
He can't be everywhere at once doing everything for everybody. Everybody can't get what they want.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this live broadcast, this 24th day of July, 2023. My name is David Stovenel, and my website is genuinechristianitynow.com. And I mentioned that right away because there will be articles posted tomorrow that have much reference as to the discussion today. The title of today's broadcast is John Quincy Adams, Letters on Freemasonry, Part 5. Anyway, you'll want to visit genuinechristianitynow.com in order to do further research on Freemasonry and how that affected the life of Billy the Kid, William Antrim, among other aliases. First of all, though, we go to reading the scriptures in 1 John chapter 3, and I'm doing verse 1 first of all, because it's important to know how much love Father God has for all of us. Behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us that we should be called the sons of God. Therefore, the world knoweth us not, because it knew him not. Now, on to verse 3 through 6. And every man that hath this hope in him purifieth himself, even as he is pure. Whosoever committeth sin transgresseth also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law. And you know that he was manifested to take away our sins, and in him is no sin. Whosoever abideth in him sinneth not. Whosoever sinneth hath not seen him, neither known him. That's the end of the reading of the scripture for today. Now, I read that for a very specific reason, because this history of Freemasonry worldwide, but dialing it into New Mexico at a very formative time in this nation's history, and a specific young man named William Bonney, alias Billy the Kid, is very instrumental in understanding how Freemasonry operates in the shadows and causes wanton death and destruction and misery. Freemasonry is vicious, and that's the conclusion I've drawn. Please do not accept my allegation. Take it as an allegation and do the studying about this, because there is not enough investigation and study exactly what is the Freemasonic rinse and repeat effort that literally gives them somehow power to access and gain power over other people. And of course, it's about occultism. But anyway, everybody has heard the name Billy the Kid or William Bonney, or watched the movies with the Emilio Estevez playing Billy the Kid in Young Guns 1 and Young Guns 2. Everybody's heard the name Billy the Kid. Everybody. But how many have heard the name of a lawyer, a Freemason and lawyer named Thomas B. Catron? Anyway, on the Wikipedia website for Thomas B. Catron, under the section land acquisition, I find this to be very profound. As a lawyer familiar with the intricacies of old Mexican land grants, Catron gained an interest in or clear title to 34 grants totaling 3 million acres. As a member of the group of land speculators known as the Santa Fe Ring, he was the largest single landowner in New Mexico and one of the largest landowners in the United States. Now, what about the Santa Fe Ring? The Santa Fe Ring was a group of powerful attorneys and land speculators in the United States during the late 19th century and into the early 20th century. It amassed a fortune through political corruption and fraudulent land deals. Many prominent people in New Mexico territory were involved in the Santa Fe Ring. Now, regarding the book, John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry, that can be and should be ordered by every single one that's listening and studied carefully, because so little is known about Freemasonry, while so many times the word Freemasonry is bandied about as if there are 10 million experts on the subject matter here in this nation that are in the alternate media. Well, anyway, this is one of the most profound books I've ever ordered and read through, called John Quincy Adams' Letters on Freemasonry. It can be ordered, and I have no economic interest in this. I called Jerry Barrett and asked him if I could quote from the book and also encourage people to buy a copy of this, and he said he didn't have any problems with that. Anyway, it's called River Crest Publishing, and it's at Patterson Road, 1708 Patterson Road, and it's at Austin, Texas. Now, on the back cover, here's what it says. Masonry ought forever to be abolished. It is wrong, essentially wrong, a seed of evil which can never produce any good. And then it goes further to say, John Quincy Adams, sixth president of the United States, was a determined opponent of the secret society and fraternity of Freemasonry, the Masonic Lodge. The question of Freemasonry and the controversy over its character has long been debated. But for John Quincy Adams, writer, poet, faithful husband, patriot, former ambassador and secretary of state and president, there was no question. The teachings and practices of the lodge, Adams asserted, are detrimental, noxious, and unfortunate. John Quincy Adams was persuaded that the Masonic lodges were a bane to society, evil, and Luciferian. This unusual book, Letters on Freemasonry, first published in 1833, is finally back in print. Until now, it was virtually impossible for the general public to obtain a copy. It is highly recommended to historians and ordinary citizens alike. Men who are members of the lodge, even if they disagree, will find in this volume insightful and astute observations on their society. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, this can be ordered from Rivercrest Publishing in Austin, Texas. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to listen to an audio of a man that studied the life and the death of Billy the Kid.
Those that support maintaining the historical status quo claim that William Henry Roberts knew very few details about the Lincoln County War, and what he did know was probably acquired from reading Walter Noble Burns' book, The Saga of Billy the Kid. Which is interesting, as up until recent times, these same supporters have claimed that Roberts was illiterate. They can't have it both ways. I've already made a video debunking the question of literacy, and will post the link in the description box below. This is just another example of how these so-called experts reject any form of responsibility and accountability and simply change their positions when proven wrong and act as if nothing occurred. They simply regurgitate unsubstantiated claims and hope no one ever calls them out and asks for evidence or source citations to support their claims. In 1948 and 1949, William V. Morrison conducted a series of tape-recorded interviews with William Henry Roberts. And during these interviews, Roberts demonstrated an amazing knowledge of the Lincoln County War and revealed little-known details relevant to the life and times of Billy the Kid. In this episode, we'll review Roberts' statements and see if they can be substantiated by verifiable sources and show the stark differences between Roberts' statements and those presented in the Burns book. In some instances, Roberts made statements that at the time were contrary to what was commonly believed by researchers and historians, only to later be proven correct by later historical records and research. The interviews between Morrison and Roberts took place on July 29, 1948 at Hyco, Texas, June 16, 1949 at Hamilton, Texas, June 17, 1949 at Hyco, Texas, and August 18, 1949 at Lincoln and Carrizozo, New Mexico. And according to C.L. Sonnichsen and Frederick Bean, who listened to and transcribed the interviews, stated that the recordings consisted of 8 6-inch reels and noted that, quote, Roberts spoke confidently, answering all of Morrison's questions without hesitating and compromising, and that Roberts spoke authoritatively, end quote. Bean and Sonnichsen also added that when Roberts spoke of killing someone or discussing the death of a friend, he would often become emotional and weep. During the interviews, Morrison would sometimes ask Roberts the same questions, and Roberts would only make slight variations in his answers. In order to avoid being repetitive, I will give the answer that Roberts offered the most details. I will be quoting directly from the original transcripts. Some quotes from these transcripts originally appeared in the following books: Alias Billy the Kid by William B. Morrison and C.L. Sonnichsen, The Return of the Outlaw Billy the Kid by W.C. Jameson and Frederick Bean, The Real Billy the Kid, a.k.a. Brushy Bill Roberts, by Brett Hall, Billy the Kid, The Lost Interviews, by W.C. Jameson, and Billy the Kid, Beyond the Grave, also by W.C. Jameson. To set the Lincoln County War into perspective, it should first be mentioned that there were two previous conflicts which would eventually set the stage for the main event. The first was the Horrell War, which took place from December 1, 1873 through March 1874, with the reemergence of the Horrell family from Texas. This conflict was actually motivated by racial prejudice, pitting Anglos against Mexicans. As the conflict would escalate, the Anglos turned on the Horrell clan and their allies scattered throughout the Ruidoso Valley, forcing them to leave the county. I believe that the effects of the Horrell War would play a significant role when discussing the details of the shooting at Fort Sumner in a future episode. I believe the racial tensions brought on by the Horrell War would lead to a great distrust by Mexicans and Hispanics throughout the area, especially towards Anglos they didn't know. I believe this is why they would often tell different versions to white interviewers than to other Hispanics, friends, and family members. The second conflict, known as the Pecos War, was the result of a dispute between cattle baron John Chisholm and a group of smaller ranchers from Seven Rivers. The conflict exploded in 1877 and would find Chisholm as the loser of this dispute after the Seven Rivers ranchers were able to block his expansion from protruding onto their lands. The Pecos War would lead to an intense hatred generated amongst the Seven Rivers ranchers against Chisholm and any of his friends or associates. That bitter sentiment would lead to the Seven Rivers Ranchers Alliance with the Murphy-Dolan faction during the Lincoln County War. Lincoln County, New Mexico was reorganized on February 15, 1878. It would become the largest county in the United States, located in the southeast quarter of the New Mexico Territory, and was named after President Abraham Lincoln. In the late 1860s, Apache Indians primarily inhabited Lincoln County. However, Anglo and Mexican settlers would soon realize the prosperous ranching and farming possibilities and would eventually push the Apaches back enough to safely settle the area. During the time of the Lincoln County War, Lincoln County measured over 27,000 square miles and was approximately the same size as the state of South Carolina. Despite its vast size, Lincoln County only had one sheriff and one or two deputies to keep the peace and enforce the law. Following the close of the Civil War, many Union and Confederate veterans would settle in the area. Among the many Union veterans who chose to settle in Lincoln County were Major Lawrence G. Murphy and Colonel Emil Fritz. They would soon launch a business partnership called L.G. Murphy & Company. This partnership, also known as the Big Store, was a monopoly and controlled the local economy as well as the government contracts in the area. The business practices of Murphy & Company were so shady that the United States government ordered them off of Fort Stanton. Murphy & Company would then move the Big Store to Lincoln County, New Mexico, the county seat. L.G. Murphy began to involve himself more deeply in the political scene following his arrival in Lincoln, and soon earned the backing of the Santa Fe Ring, a group of businessmen and politicians who controlled Lincoln County. Thomas B. Catron and Stephen B. Elkins founded and controlled the Santa Fe Ring. It was about this time friction began to develop between Murphy and Chisholm. Each was accusing the other of stealing the other's cattle. In 1874, Emil Fritz died, and James J. Dolan and J. H. Riley stepped in as partners with Murphy. John H. Tunstall was a British citizen and the son of a wealthy English businessman. In 1872, he sailed from his homeland to British Columbia, Canada, to oversee one of his father's partnerships, Turner, Beaton, and Tunstall Limited of Victoria, British Columbia. The young Tunstall soon found this work unappealing and longed to make his own fortune. In the early part of 1876, he left Canada, and following a brief stop in California, he arrived in New Mexico Territory in search of his fortune. Not long after landing in New Mexico, Tunstall met Alexander A. McSween, an attorney from Lincoln County, New Mexico, and former employee of L.G. Murphy & Company, who advised the young Englishman to seek his fortune in Lincoln. McSween must have made a good impression on Tunstall, for he soon purchased a 4,000-acre ranch along the Rio Feliz. Tunstall, being a British citizen, was not eligible for homestead public lands, so McSween had to file on the land and sell it to his new friend. Once Tunstall had a ranch in stock, he then proceeded to open a store and then a bank in direct competition with L.G. Murphy & Company. The Lincoln County Bank, of which Tunstall owned and to which John Chisholm would act as president and McSween as vice president. Tunstall's ambitions posed a serious risk to the Murphy-Dolan monopoly, which wasn't the least bit thrilled about the prospect of fair market competition. Thus the seeds were planted, which would grow into the bloody event known as the Lincoln County War. During his tape-recorded interviews with William B. Morrison, Brushy Bill Roberts related numerous intimate details pertaining to the Lincoln County War. Roberts was able to relate information so esoteric that it could only have come from someone who was present when it occurred. The only alterations I will make when quoting from these interviews is when Roberts uses a racial slur to refer to Colonel Dudley's troops. I will simply refer to them as black soldiers, where he used the derogatory word. Now let's examine Roberts' statements. Quote, "In the summer of 1877, Tom O'Keefe and I left for Mesilla, for Loving's Bend near Phoenix, New Mexico. We had a run-in with some Indians in the Guadalupe Mountains, and I got lost and lost my horse in the mountains during the fight. I struggled through them mountains, and I wound up at the Jones place at Seven Rivers. My feet were all cut up, and I had walked several days through the mountain brush. Jim and John Jones were working for Chisholm, so I went to work with them. I think up at the Bosque Grande. Frank McNabb was foreman. Later Chisholm moved to South Spring, I think. Tom Story, Mills Fisher, Walker, Goss Black, and Ketchum worked there too, I think. Sally Chisholm was already there when I went to work for Chisholm. She wasn't old John's daughter. I think she was his niece. Her daddy was all right then, though. I made a cattle drive to Dodge City that fall with Chisholm's outfit. We went up the Loving Trail, I think, or the Goodnight Trail. I don't remember now. Maybe both of them run cattle on that trail. That was before my time. It was a good wide trail that connected with other trails farther up. This is the time we had that tintype picture made at the end of the cattle trail in Dodge City. I bought my first horse in that country from Chisholm when I went to work with the Jones boys. He had that little roan that was wild and could run, so I bought him and paid for him out of my pay from Chisholm. I left Chisholm and worked for Maxwell a short time at Bosque Redondo. Then I went over to Frank Coe's place in the Rio Doso. While there I run into Jesse Evans and Frank Baker again. They took me to Murphy's cow camp in the Seven Rivers country. Evans and his gang stole cattle from Chisholm, and some horses, too. They still had some of the horses when I went to work with them at Murphy's Seven Rivers camp that winter. They had stolen this roan, too, but he got back to the ranch. Later on, we got into an argument about my share of the bunch of cattle we cut out and one of the horses I was supposed to get, and they welched on the deal. Baker accused me of stealing the little roan that I rode up there on when I went to work with them. I told him I bought the horse from Chisholm with my own money, and I aimed to keep him, too, I did. I had both six-shooters on him when I said it, but Jesse knocked the right one down. I swung the other over with my left hand and held it right in his ribs while I told him. He told the boys to keep still or suffer the consequences, and begged me to leave peacefully. End quote. Now let's examine the account presented in Walter Noble Burns' book, The Saga of Billy the Kid. Burns fails to mention Billy arriving at the Jones place or working at Chisholm's ranch, and has Billy arriving first at Murphy's cow camp, then to Frank Coe's, before settling at Tunstall's ranch. Burns doesn't mention rustling cattle and horses with Baker, Morton, and Evans, nor does he recount the incident involving the fallout with the three men. He doesn't mention the men that Roberts names as being at Chisholm's at this time. In fact, the only similarities are of Billy arriving with Tom O'Keefe in 1877, getting separated in the mountains, and that he eventually ended up at Tunstall's. Other than that, the timeline is completely different, and Roberts' account is more detailed and has him making more stops than Burns before working for Tunstall. Roberts' account is confirmed by the following sources. Roberts' claim that he stopped at the Jones place first is confirmed in Ma'am Jones of the Pecos by Eve Ball, who interviewed Sam, Bill, Frank, and Nib Jones, who verified the story, stating that Billy arrived half-starved and with sores on his feet and stayed with the family for a short time before going to work at Chisholm's. In Billy the Kid, a biobibliography by John Tuska, Tuska writes, quote, Billy the Kid's first stop after leaving the Jones family was John Chisholm's South Spring River Ranch, where, as most visitors, he was made welcome. He remained there for a time, end quote. Roberts was correct when he identified Sally Chisholm as being John Chisholm's niece. Several researchers and historians have at times made the error of identifying Sally Chisholm as being the daughter of John Chisholm, when in fact, her father was actually James Chisholm, John's brother. Roberts' knowledge of the trails was also correct, as according to a June 2000 Wild West Magazine article titled Charles Goodnight's Cattle Days by Troy D. Smith. The Goodnight Loving Trail was created by trailblazers Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving. The trail began in June 1866 near Fort Belknap, Texas, and extended to Fort Sumner, New Mexico. It was later extended into Colorado and Wyoming. The southern part of the trail was known as the Goodnight Trail. The northern portion was referred to as the Loving Trail. The trail connected with numerous other trails along the way. In July 1950, William V. Morrison and Brushy Bill Roberts visited with Sam and Bill Jones at the home of Sam Jones's daughter in Carlsbad, New Mexico. This picture was produced. Sam Jones possessed the original tintype. The brothers then identified the men appearing in the photograph as being Jim Jones, Bob Speaks, John Jones, and Billy the Kid. Jim and John Jones were the brother of Sam and Bill Jones. According to Charles Frederick Rudolph in the book Los Bolitos, the story of Billy the Kid and his gang, quote, early spring of that year found Billy working for a short period at John Chisholm's ranch, taking part in a trail drive to Dodge City, Kansas, under the leadership of Bob Speaks, Chisholm's trail boss, together with Jim and John Jones, brothers, end quote. This grants further credence to the story told by Roberts, as well as his identification of the men in the photograph. The source is credible since the Rudolph family was well acquainted with Billy the Kid during his days in New Mexico. Roberts stated that he went to work for Maxwell briefly after leaving Chisholm's, and is verified by J.W. Hendron in The Story of Billy the Kid, New Mexico's number one desperado. Hendron writes that the Kid then worked for Julian Maxwell, who offered him $15 a month and a bunk and board. This event is not commonly known and was not mentioned in the saga of Billy the Kid at all, but Roberts mentioned it. According to George Coe, former Lincoln County regulator and a friend of Billy the Kid, who confirmed the account of Roberts living with Frank Coe in his book Frontier Fighter, adding that during this time, he and Frank would play the fiddle while Billy laughed and danced. He also stated that the Kid stayed with them for the greater part of that winter. On his falling out with Jesse Evans, Morton, and Baker, which while not mentioned in the saga of Billy the Kid, was confirmed by George Coe, who would confirm Robert's account by stating in Frontier Fighter, quote, "He, Billy the Kid, turned up unexpectedly at Seven Rivers looking for Jesse Evans, his old friend from Mesilla Park. Jesse, Billy Morton, and Frank Baker were driving some cattle through to Lincoln and offered the kid a job helping them with the drive. They said they were to receive $5 a head for delivering them in Lincoln. They started with only a few head, but by the time they arrived, the herd was miraculously increased. When Billy asked for his wages, Morton and Baker quibbled over the amount and finally refused to pay him, saying, 'You are about the dirtiest bunch of curs I ever met,' said Billy. 'You little devil,' shouted Morton. 'We've had about all we want out of you. Clear out.' With an intriguing smile, Billy answered, 'That's where we differ. I haven't had enough of you yet.' With that, he jerked out his revolver and would have killed them both on the spot before the intervention of Jesse Evans. Billy told them where to go and then left them and rode on into Lincoln." End quote. Quote, "You know, Jesse and I were nearly like brothers. We had roamed New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, and Old Mexico together. Jesse and I argued, and I nearly killed him one day in Lincoln, but I always felt close to him. I tried to spring him from jail in Stockton one time after they killed Chapman. I almost killed Baker and Morton that time. Guess I should have done it, but I didn't." End quote. In Jesse Evans, The Texas Hideburner by Ed Bartholomew, Jesse Evans was arrested on July 3, 1880, for the murder of Susan McSween's attorney, Houston Chapman. And Bartholomew quotes a letter dated August 26, 1880, from Lieutenant Charles L. Neville, one of the officers of the fort that held Evans and his gang, to his superior, J.B. Jones, which supports Robert's claim. The letter states, quote, "The prisoners are getting restless. I have a letter they wrote to a friend of Evans in New Mexico, calling himself Billy Antrim, to cause their rescue, and to use his words, he was in a damn tight place, only 14 rangers here any time, 10 on a scout, and only 4 in camp now. And that Antrim and a few men could take them out very easy, and that he could not do it now to meet him, Evans, on the road to Huntsville Prison, as he was certain to go. I understand this man Antrim is a fugitive from somewhere, and a noted desperado. If he comes here, and I expect he will, I will enlist him for a while and put him in the same mess with Evans and company." End quote. In a letter dated September 5, 1880, from Lieutenant Neville to J.B. Jones, Neville writes, quote, "I have been informed that there is a party made up in Lincoln County, New Mexico, headed by one Billy Antrim, alias Kid, for the purpose of releasing Jesse Evans and his gang. If so, they may be here in a day or two. This information is from a reliable source." End quote. This incident isn't commonly known and isn't included in even many modern-day books about Billy the Kid and the Lincoln County War. It wasn't mentioned by Burns in his book at all, but once again, Roberts did. Quote, "Well, after Jesse told them to keep still, I jumped on my little roan pony and rode back toward Tunstall's ranch on the Feliz. I was on my way to Coe's place. I stopped at Tunstall's to get something to eat. We always rode up to ranch houses when we got hungry. I knew some of the boys there. Dick Brewer was foreman. Beaudry had left Chisholm and went to Tunstall's. John Middleton, Doc Skurlock, Bob Wiedemann, and lots of others were there, too. Dick Brewer, the foreman, was a friend of Coe, and I told him I was headed back there, as I had had trouble with Murphy's men. After eating that day, Tunstall said that I might as well stay there with the boys, so he hired me to ride for him. That's the way I met Tunstall." End quote. In his autobiography, Frontier Fighter, George Coe affirmed Robert's account of being introduced to Tunstall by stating that Tunstall, quote, "was drawn toward the boy and invited him to lunch," end quote. In the saga of Billy the Kid, Burns doesn't mention Roberts and Coe's account of Billy having lunch with Tunstall, whereas he just has him, quote, "eventually taking employment at Tunstall's ranch on the Rio Feliz to remain there until the murder of the Englishman launched the Lincoln County War," end quote. Burns doesn't mention the names of the other men employed by Tunstall at this point, further proving that the accounts presented by Roberts and Burns are vastly different. George Coe confirmed his presence, as well as the other men named by Roberts. Quote, "John Middleton was lots older than the rest of us. He was as mean as hell, a heavy drinker. Tom Fyard was about the age of Jesse Evans and me. Tom was a big fellow, Jesse and me were small. Tom was good, but liked to drink some. Charlie Beaudry was older than us. He was a good man, could shoot quick. Rudabaugh was the toughest I ever knew. He was older and rougher and had been through lots of trouble. I saw him in Sonora after the shooting at Maxwell's when they thought they had killed me. He was calm, not easily excited. Tom Pickett and Billy Wilson were not bad men. I don't remember of seeing them in that war up there. Scurlock wasn't a bad man. He was in the war, though. Hank Brown was from a good family, but he was mean. So was Fred Waite. They left me on a cattle drive just before Scurlock, or just after him. I don't remember now. End quote. Tom Fired was a key name mentioned by Roberts. According to W.C. Jameson in his book, Billy the Kid, The Lost Interviews, Jameson writes, quote, "Nearly everything that ever been written about Billy the Kid in the Lincoln County War mentions his friend Tom Fired, but his surname was invariably spelled O. Fired. His actual name was Thomas, middle initial O. Fired. An investigation of genealogical and census records brought to light the fact that Tom Fired, a resident of Ireland, arrived in the United States prior to the Civil War. He met and married Sarah Cook and had a son, Thomas O. Fallyard. The Fallyards moved to the Mexican state of Coahuila. Tom Sr. and Sarah both died from smallpox, and young Tom was taken in and raised by a Mexican family until he could be returned to kin. John Cook, Sarah's uncle, brought young Tom to live with the family members in Uvalde, Texas, where he was raised. He was referred to as Tom O. Fallyard for the first time by Pat Garrett in his 1882 publication, The Authentic Life of Billy the Kid. In the years following the release of Authentic Life, a book replete with documented errors and fabrications, historians and writers merely copied Garrett's reference to Tom O. Fallyard, without investing any research or investigation into the provenance of the name. During his taped interviews, Roberts used Fallyard's name accurately, end quote. This is a vital piece of supporting evidence in Roberts' favor, as this fact is not commonly known, even to many modern-day Billy the Kid and Lincoln County War researchers and historians. Apparently, Morrison and Sonnichsen were unaware that Fallyard was the correct way to pronounce it and failed to note its significance. This fact was most certainly not mentioned by Burns in the saga of Billy the Kid, who uses the incorrect surname of O. Fallyard. Roberts stated that Beaudry was older than the rest. This is confirmed by Phil Rash in Warriors of Lincoln County, who cites Beaudry being born in Mississippi in 1848, which would make him about 11 years older than Billy the Kid. George Coe described him as a good man and a neighbor. None of this is mentioned by Burns in Saga. Dave Rudabaugh is a well-known outlaw, and his exploits are worthy of an entire video on their own. With that said, Roberts' description is on par with published accounts of Rudabaugh's life, specifically Dave Rudabaugh, Border Ruffian, by F. Stanley. We'll get further into Rudabaugh, Tom Pickett, and Billy Wilson in my next video, The Outlaw Years. Roberts' description of Henry Brown is another often overlooked win for Roberts. For instance, when referencing Brown, Roberts always referred to him as either Hank or Henry. Several historians and researchers have often incorrectly referred to him as Hendry. In the book Henry Brown, The Outlaw Marshal, by Bill O'Neill, it states, quote, "The name Hendry evidently was the result of a spelling error by a New Mexico court clerk. Official records in Kansas and Missouri repeatedly list Brown's name as Henry, and these sources were more sophisticated and reliable than those of the sparsely settled Lincoln County and the Texas Panhandle of the 1870s and 1880s," end quote. Walter Noble Burns incorrectly referred to Brown as Hendry and not Henry. Once again, Roberts is correct and Burns is wrong. Quote, "Tunstall had a store in Lincoln in opposition to Murphy and Dolan. McSween became a partner with Tunstall. Then old John Chisholm joined them. Murphy men had been rounding up old John's cattle and selling them to the army at Fort Stanton. Then Chisholm would pay us boys a dollar a head to get his cattle back. That is how the cattle war got started, if you want to know it. Tunstall got mixed up in it through McSween and Murphy's troubles. McSween had worked for Murphy as his lawyer. Later McSween joined forces with Chisholm, and the trouble got worse. The Murphy bunch had come to Lincoln before McSween and Tunstall got there. Murphy and Dolan had been filling government contracts for beef and provisions. McSween was hired by Murphy to prosecute the Chisholm cowboys for cattle rustling, McSween found out that Chisholm was only taking his own cattle from the Murphy boys, so he quit Murphy and started up with Tunstall, who had come in from England to settle in this country. He raised blooded horses and ranched cattle in the Falaise. From this time on, there were two factions fighting to get the business. Each accused the other of cattle stealing. I guess both of them were right about it. The Murphy bunch had the backing of the Santa Fe Ring, which included Tom Catron, U.S. District Attorney, and his brother-in-law. Of course, they were not out in the open with it, but during the cattle war, old Tom took over the Murphy Dolan property. All the politicians belonged to the Santa Fe Ring, even judges and attorneys. They was all Masons, too. They was all in it together. End quote. Tom Catron and the Santa Fe Ring are not discussed in Walter Noble Burns' book, nor is the correct statement made by Roberts that Tom Catron took possession of Murphy and Dolan's property at the end of the conflict. He was also correct in identifying them as being Freemasons. This is confirmed in The Life and Death of John Henry Tunstall by Frederick Nolan, who stated that, quote, Murphy, an ardent Mason, became well connected with Thomas B. Catron, one of the founders of the Santa Fe Ring, through membership in the territory's first Masonic Lodge, end quote. Robert's statement that Catron took over the Murphy Dolan property was verified in Violence in Lincoln County by William Kelleher, who wrote, quote, after Murphy's death, his ranch was acquired by Thomas Catron, who sold it in October 1882, end quote. And by Colonel Maurice G. Fulton in History of the Lincoln County War, who wrote, quote, the five-day battle at Lincoln in July 1878, though it resulted in the death of Alex McSween and the dispersal of his supporters, was for Jimmy Dolan, at best, a Pyrrhic victory. The J.J. Dolan and Company store had been lost by mortgage foreclosure to T.B. Catron. End quote. Quote, Brady the sheriff wasn't any better than anyone else up there. He was a Catron man, and he did just as they told him. He had threatened to kill Tunstall several times. That attorney that prosecuted me in Lincoln County that time, and the judge too, were Catron men. How could a person get justice among them? The law wasn't no good. Later on, the governor was put out of office by the President of the United States. End quote. Walter Noble Burns never discussed Catron and his Santa Fe Ring in the saga of Billy the Kid. However, Roberts' claim that Brady, Bristol, and Reinerson were Catron men was supported in Frederick Nolan's The Life and Death of John Henry Tunstall.
Well, there you have it. Now we have about 20 minutes to go, and the call-in number is 608-433-9306. Letters on Freemasonry. This is about Freemasonry in general, and it's about the Lincoln County War and Billy the Kid in particular. And so those of you that might want to call in and offer whatever you have learned about this and or want to learn about it, once again, it's 608-433-9306. Now, there's an article in the Los Angeles Times about almost 30 years ago, and it wraps up with this. Tunstall ranch hand William Bonney, Billy the Kid, and his trail mates, the Regulators, staged counterattacks, killing several House partisans, including Sheriff Brady. As things escalated, the white hats became grayer, and by the end, the regulators were as ruthless and as deadly as their enemies, said Jacobson. Bonney's death at the hands of Sheriff Pat Garrett came after the war had ended. Now, there's two things about these sentences here. One of them, it has in it, killing several House partisans. Now, I'm trying to familiarize myself with exactly what that would mean, because there was a man shortly after this period of time whose son worked for a Democrat that became the president. And he even wrote a book about socialism primarily, and how to run people's lives. They were Texans. And anyway, his dad, his name was House, and I'm curious to know if that House, if that's what this particular comment refers to by this author, or if it is a pseudonym, a metaphor for one of these organizations. I'm not clear about that. I'm just not clear about it. So that is a question in my mind yet, but it's a huge question, because if this refers to that family of Jews, as I understand it, they were Ashkenazi Jews that changed their last name to House, and it was H-U-I-S-E or something like that, but they changed their name. So that's a possibility, but I'm not sure. So I'm still trying to discover that. And so if anyone that is listening would care to call in and clarify, if they can provide me with any clarification of whether that was the name, a family name of a large group and organization. Obviously, the House family was a powerful family that was well-rounded and backed by other powerful people, or one of the House sons would not have ended up telling one of the Democrat presidents what to do, that it, quite frankly, was the one that convinced our Congress to commit us to enter World War I. So this is all really intriguing. Anyway, this was in the Los Angeles Times, this article, after a man that was a lawyer in California, or excuse me, in New Mexico. And he lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he studied this and wrote a book. And the title of the article, it's from March 19th, 1995. It's titled, Billy the Kid and Lincoln County War, Economics of Gunslinging, History. New Mexico violence grew out of official corruption, says author, a prosecutor who takes a lawyerly look at what triggered the infamous bloodbath. And once again, if I don't get any callers because the time is running short, there's a little more than 15 minutes left, but the number is 608-433-9306. And here's what the article reads that's in the Los Angeles Times back in March 19th, 1995. And it was an Associated Press article, incidentally, and it's datelined at Albuquerque, New Mexico. Take a corrupt chain of command, ranging from governor to army officers, judges, prosecutors, sheriffs, and Indian agents, add land grabbers, muster out seething Civil War malcontents, stir in Billy the Kid. The Lincoln County War was a textbook worst-case scenario, one that could be taught in law schools. And now a state prosecutor has taken a dispassionate, lawyerly look at what triggered New Mexico's most infamous bloodbath. Joel Jacobson, an assistant state attorney general, has written, such men as Billy the Kid. It is an unofficial indictment against several key players in the conflict. Incidentally, Thomas B. Catron was cited. He was with the Southern side in the Civil War. He was a rebel. He was a Confederate, just for your information on that personality, who I hope you discover who Thomas B. Catron was a little more deeply than what you now know. Anyway, Jacobson studies the economics and politics, not just the shooting. I haven't read this book yet, but I intend to. I intend to order a copy and read it. Once again, this is the primary investigation here is Freemasonry. Secondarily, it's more specific, the Lincoln County War. Jacobson studies the economic and politics, not just the shooting. Lincoln County's troubles began in the mid-1870s after the Army's focus shifted from the Civil War to the Mescalero Apache Reservation just south of Lincoln. A monopolistic Lincoln Commodities brokerage, the House, so that's a brokerage in that sense, but I wonder if it was established by the House family. A monopolistic Lincoln Commodities brokerage, the House, held government contracts to supply horses, cattle, and grain to the reservation through the Indian agent and to the Army through the Fort Stanton commander. The House also lent money to ranchers, paid them criminally low prices, and regularly foreclosed on them. It was a pattern. I think it was amply racketeering, Jacobson said during an interview at his Albuquerque office. The House was founded by retired Union Army quartermaster Lawrence Murphy, who also was county probate judge. Once again, was he working for the man that ultimately was called Colonel House, or Colonel House's father, in this effort to found this organization, this agency called the House? That meant, Jacobson said, that Murphy oversaw trade with the Mescaleros, putting himself in charge of making sure his own firm lived up to its obligations. The probate judge also controlled the county treasury, including the sheriff's payroll. Rulings by the county's five justices of the peace were appealed to the probate judge. In a digression, I have to make another comment. Lincoln County, New Mexico, is as large as either one of the Carolinas, North Carolina or South Carolina. It's larger than either one, actually. So this was an immense amount of cash flow and power acquisition in a very short period of time. Murphy had Lincoln County locked down. And in Santa Fe, U.S. Attorney Thomas B. Ketron, a major investor in the House, had the entire territory in his control. It looked, said Jacobson, like the goose that laid the golden egg. That was about to change. The first harbinger came when Murphy, already suffering from the cancer that would shortly claim his life, lost his reelection bid as probate judge. The monopoly power of the House was only possible when the economy was small, Jacobson said. As people moved in and the economy grew, the House couldn't maintain control, he said. Competition came from an adventurous 24-year-old Englishman named John Tunstall. Now I have to digress again and say that during the presentation of that audio, it did indicate that John Tunstall started a bank. And was he operating on behalf of perhaps the Anglo-British crown, the Queen of Great Britain, Queen Elizabeth I, the first Queen Elizabeth I, or possibly the Rothschild family? That's an open question. Anyway, to continue, he wanted to live in the rough outdoors, said Jacobson. He thought about going to Alaska before coming here, so I think he was a very rugged sort of person, and he was tough. Tunstall opened a store that posed a direct threat to the house and to the dying Murphy's successors, John Riley and James Dolan. The threat was heightened by Tunstall's alignment with cattleman John Chisholm. If Chisholm began supplying stock to the army and the Indians, the house would be dead, and so would Tom Catron's $25,000 investment. And when you consider that amount, ladies and gentlemen, consider the times. This was in the 1870s. The book shows how Catron and the house carried out an illegal scheme to attach Tunstall's assets, closing his store and seizing his livestock. It required cooperation from the governor, a district judge, the district attorney, Sheriff William Brady, and a posse of deputized criminals, many of them ex-army comrades. But Tunstall wouldn't go away and refused to be drawn into violence despite repeated provocations, Jacobson said. He was complying with the attachment order, even though it was very abusive, said the author. He was killed when he was leaving his ranch, tracked down and killed. Jacobson believed the decision to kill Tunstall was made by posse members. Others aligned with Tunstall also were killed during the war, leaving the Tunstall faction rudderless, Jacobson said. And to repeat now, Tunstall ranch hand William Bonney, Billy the Kid, and his trail mates, the Regulators, staged counterattacks, killing several house partisans, including Sheriff Brady. As things escalated, the white hats became grayer, and by the end, the Regulators were as ruthless and as deadly as their enemies, said Jacobson. Bonney's death at the hands of Sheriff Pat Garrett came after the war had ended. Who would have given that order to keep the killing going after the war had ended, ladies and gentlemen? Anyway, Jacobson, who says the book took 12 years to complete, recalls becoming enthralled with the legend of Billy the Kid as a boy of 11 when he stopped on a summer vacation at a museum in Fort Sumner. Billy the Kid's grave is behind the museum. Now this is an article that will be posted on my website in order that you can not have to write down or remember the name of this well-researched book that was researched and written after 12 years of investigations and studying by a lawyer. And lawyers, for all the bad they do and some of the good they do, they're very thorough when they've set their mind to do something. I will give them that credit on that behalf. So this will be posted on genuinechristianitynow.com. Incidentally, I research constantly, and there is a donate button for any of you that would care to continue encouraging me and those that work for me to carry on in the manner of trying to bring forward the truth as best as can be investigated and discovered, but yet still not drawing an absolute conclusion for you as an Alice in Wonderland kind of a situation, but to bring forward information that is intriguing and important in terms of the subject matter being investigated, namely, Freemasonry. Is it ironic or is it violent? Is it vicious? That's a huge question and deserves an answer. And it also should come to everyone's mind whenever anyone is campaigning for office, whenever they are conducting business in a large manner or small manner for that matter with anyone, to inquire if someone is a Freemason or not, because we are founded with all their flaws and faults. The people that founded that designed and developed the Constitution for the United States lifted up an ideal of equality, of fairness at law for everyone. And certainly if there's an organized group that operates in secret to leverage their power and authority over others, that certainly would be the opposite of the ideal that the founding fathers in the exoteric, in the openness, lifted up. And some of them were Freemasons, there's no question about that. But anyway, that's the end of that article, and it will be posted on my website. Now, here's a conclusion I've drawn, and I'm going to say this, but I'm going to heavily encourage each one of you to not just take on its face any conclusion I've drawn on my behalf as a result of the deep amount of research work I've done, because I don't know any one of you. I'm just broadcasting this in order to try to stimulate you to start investigating and reporting and inquiring for yourselves. But anyway, this is the conclusions I've drawn. Two very profound conclusions. Dogs and Freemasons always mark their territory with their own self-produced filth. And the second conclusion I've drawn is Freemasonry is both negative and positive Lucifer-Satan worship. How can Lucifer-Satan worship be positive, you might ask? Well, positive has more than one definition, and the definition that I'm intending with that conclusion, within that conclusion, is positive actions. In other words, if they operate in secret to decide to murder someone, that is a positive action. In other words, calling a meeting and saying, this man has to be killed. So create a circumstance where we have to declare war, or in the individual circumstance. For example, one of my friends that did a lot of hard work for me over the years was killed on June 16. His name is William Stephen Boardman, and I live in Vernon County, Wisconsin, for any of you that would care to research that work. He was shot and killed by a policeman. So that would be what would be called a positive. There was a positive plan in place to do something to what he went by Steve, to Steve Boardman. And he's dead now. And once again, I'm drawing the conclusion that Freemasons were involved. And I'm drawing that conclusion because there are Freemasons here in Vernon County that I am aware of. And I do a lot of research, and I do a lot of reporting that other people have difficulties in deciding. But anyway, if you go to midnightfreemasons.org, you can see the Masonic Lodge in New Mexico's old Lincoln County Courthouse, where they have a room set up for Freemasonry. Thank you for listening.